This week, stocks rebounded from oversold conditions, sending the Dow Industrials up over 300 points. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you for another big show on this Good Friday holiday weekend. My first guest, the head of Euro-Pacific Capital, Peter Schiff, says that our officials want us to believe that inflation is essential for economic welfare. Well, that's not the case. Falling prices may lead to improved living conditions. This was a key to our economic success as a nation for over 200 years. And the short sellers and ETFs are caught on the wrong side of the trade, selling gold they don't own, and they're going to have to buy it back at higher prices, says Peter Schiff. But with Asian nations accumulating the metal at a rapid clip, where will they find the bullion? Gold will reach parity with the Dow, probably somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000. But it's the mining sector that he likes the best, with solid price-to-earnings valuations, especially as gold and silver rebounds in 2014. The Fed will continue to print currency, and eventually confidence will flail, sending a tidal wave of funds into the sector. Dennis Miller, retirement specialist and head of MillersMoney.com, says that gold investors need to take steps to fund their retirement by adding another safe haven investment to the mix. He likes two bond funds, including one high-yield Guggenheim fund, to help improve diversification of assets, which he says is still the hallmark of investing success. The Fed is running out of QE bullets. Eventually, a 1929 or even 2008-like crisis will unfold, making gold, silver, and bonds essential life preservers for every portfolio. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather report. Clouds appeared over the precious metals exchanges this week amid a rally in the U.S. dollar market. The greenback gained strength on robust domestic economic reports. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, investors locked in some profits, though. Gold dropped only $26, ending at $12.94 an ounce. The yellow metal is still higher by over 5% for the year. Silver shed about half a dollar, not quite, ending at $19.53. Palladium fell $10, closing at $7.96 on supply concerns amid continued tensions between Russia and the West. Platinum dropped on signs of progress between labor and producers in South Africa, the world's biggest producer. The metal fell $41, finishing at $14.15. South Africa's top producers offered to more than double the wages of their lowest paid workers within 3 years, as the strike that had damaged operations entered its fourth month. But West Texas Intermediate crude bucked the trend, gaining $1.25, ending at $104.50 per barrel on concerns over potential supply disruptions from Russia. And in the Alpha Stocks newsletter, our oil-related trusts and picks continue to outperform most other sectors with big dividend yields as well, and some of them even carrying virtually tax-free dividends, taxed at ordinary income. So if you haven't already signed up, send over an email or just click the links at the webpage. Meanwhile, gold has been the go-to asset class of 2014 on safe haven demand, thanks in part to turmoil in Ukraine. Diplomats from Russia and the U.S. as well as the European Union will meet for discussions in Geneva over the weekend to ease tensions between Kiev and Moscow. The diplomats issued a joint statement Thursday calling for the disarming of all illegal armed militias and the return of all illegally seized buildings, according to a CNN report. Russian President Vladimir Putin said the Ukrainian government was at fault for sending in troops to resolve unrest in Ukraine, a conflict that resulted with 3 pro-Russian protester fatalities and 13 casualties. Ukrainian forces are confronting pro-Russian separatists in the eastern periphery of the nation. The local parliaments of 2 regions are demanding referendums to secede from Ukraine, similar to what occurred in Crimea. Ukrainian troops retook state buildings from ethnic Russians. So far, the U.S. response is somewhat uninspiring. A White House spokesman noted plans for military assistance to Ukraine, but no direct military actions. As one would expect, gold remains a life preserver for everyone in the nation, fortunate enough to have access to the metal. The national economy is nearing collapse levels, and the currency has earned the unfortunate moniker of the worst performing money of the year. Nevertheless, gold has soared roughly 70% in terms of the Ukrainian currency in just a few months. sending the cost of everyday goods sky high, just as jobs are disappearing amid economic collapse. And as a side note here, a key walkaway point, the nation is facing a depression and potentially runaway inflation at the same time. If something similar were to occur in the U.S., unemployment could soar to over 50%, and staple items like groceries, gasoline, medicines, heating, and electricity could soar several fold, putting the means of survival well beyond hundreds of millions of Americans. Even those who consider themselves viable today with McMansion debt shacks, mortgages, debt-filled Hummers, and credit card nooses could find themselves falling on very hard times. Moral of the story? Start preparing now. Moving on, yesterday the EU Parliament announced new rules on how to deal with banking solvency issues. Europe's banking union has organized a single resolution mechanism and a 55 billion euro fund as a bailout mechanism. The legislation was overwhelmingly approved in Parliament, but here is the rub. The Restructuring and Resolution Directive shifts the burden of bank failures from taxpayers to creditors, both bondholders and depositors. Now, the Directive on Deposit Guarantee Schemes further shifts the burden. Deposits over 100,000 euros are now vulnerable to bail-ins and deposit confiscation. So there you have it. Expect a systemic Greek-style savings bailout for anyone with over 100,000 euros in the bank. Thanks to Mark Byrne at Gold Money for this excellent investigative report. I hope that investors will prepare in Europe and North America for similar legislation. The only safe haven worth the trouble from this type of fiasco, precious metals. And back across the pond, the dollar recoiled a bit after the Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen noted that monetary stimulus plans will continue. Investors interpreted the comments to indicate that interest rates will remain near zero a bit longer than expected. Bottom line on precious metals. Although there were clear signs of accumulation in silver and gold later in the week, the XAU is still vulnerable to further selling. For the time being, extreme caution is advised. Discounted prices are expected on the horizon. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange this week following comments from the new Fed chair that stimulus and low rates could persist longer than expected. Plus, solid employment and consumer confidence figures indicate that the economic recovery is still on track. For the week, the Dow gained nearly all but 4 points of last week's losses, adding 381, ending at 16,408, higher by about 2.5%. The S&P 500 picked up 49 points, up about 3%, finishing at 1864, while the NASDAQ regained key support above 4,000, ending at 4,095, up over 2% for the week. On the domestic news front, consumer confidence soared on news that people are more sanguine over the prospects of the economy. Meanwhile, unemployment claims fell to the lowest level in almost 7 years. According to the Federal Reserve Bank Philadelphia Factory Index, regional manufacturing picked up in April better than expected. And consumer confidence rose from a 9-week low as Americans grow more upbeat about the economy. The Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia Factory Index, a gauge of manufacturing, climbed to 16.6 in April, topping estimates. Bottom line on Wall Street, well, the seven-component sentiment index that we watch so closely here remains firmly in the fear category. This is great news for the bulls because despite the sharp rebound we saw this week, well, the typical investor out there is shaking in his boots. So from a contrarian perspective, this is fantastic. Markets do like to climb that wall of worry, and that's what we're seeing here. The average investor is doing that right now. He's worrying. So are we worrying? No way. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Dennis Miller and Peter Schiff. We'd like for you to stay with us here at GoldSeek. Well, my featured guest today says that gold will be the trade of the year. Peter Schiff is President and Chief Global Strategist of Euro Pacific Capital and best-selling author. Welcome back, Peter Schiff.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, you know, in a recent article, you take the mainline press to task over their assessment of inflation versus deflation. You say that the powers that be have it all wrong. Inflation is the cause of all kinds of trouble in our economy. High prices are only a symptom of the inflation. It's not the cause, though. Could you please tell folks what's behind these higher prices, that it's more than likely monetary expansion?
Not everybody is blaming everything on the weather these days, and the problem is it's raining money, right? That is the problem with the weather. But, you know, the government is trying to launch a campaign, a fear campaign about deflation or lowflation. The government is trying to convince us that rising prices are necessary for prosperity, that rising prices stimulate consumption, they stimulate demand, as a result they lead to hiring and economic growth, and that if prices aren't rising, that the economies are going to implode. And the theoretical explanation for that is people won't spend if they don't think prices are going to go up, that they'll just postpone their purchases. But if they think prices are going to go up, then everybody will rush out to spend before the price hikes, and all that extra spending is what's going to grow the economy. And it is utter nonsense. There is nothing to fear from stable prices. There's nothing to fear from falling prices. In fact, falling prices are the byproduct of a healthy, growing economy. That's what healthy, growing economies produce, is lower prices. Because as you increase production, you increase the supply of goods. You find more innovative ways to produce goods so that the price of the goods can come down. And it's falling prices that leads to higher living standards. Because what makes products affordable is prices going down. The reason that people are poor is because they can't afford to buy the things that they want or the things that they need. Well, the way you alleviate poverty is to bring prices down. And when prices come down, people can afford things. And now they have a better standard of living. And so the history of America, if you study 19th century America, the history is falling prices. That's the secret to our success, is that capitalism brought prices down. And even in this century, you can see pockets of falling prices in consumer electronics. Why do we all have cell phones? Why are they so ubiquitous now in our society? Why does my 11-year-old have an iPhone? Because the price came down.
You recall Gordon Gekko's mobile phone was, all the rage back in, 1988?
The fact that Gordon Gekko had one, it was a novelty. It was a toy for the rich. You had to be Gordon Gekko to afford one. That was the point. Now, according to the government, it would have been better if the price of cell phones went up, if Gordon Gekko's phone was the cheapest and they just got more expensive. No! You know, this is the government is trying to convince us to fear falling prices because they want rising prices. So they might as well get us to enjoy what they're about to do to us, right? They want, you know, it's like trying to make the bitter tasting medicine go down. But the government wants us to be excited about inflation. The government wants us to think that they've done us a favor by sparing us the pain associated with prices going down, so that when prices go up, will be relieved. And they can say, this is great news. The cost of living is going up. This is great. Good job, Federal Reserve.
Well, no, exactly, because they've convinced us that by owning a debt check, okay, then we've taken on a huge amount of debt and mortgages and all the rest of it and filled the house with devices and furniture that we didn't even pay for. Half of that's on credit.
It's kind of like almost like, you know, that book Fahrenheit 451, you know, where the firemen, remember, the firemen were there to, they were there to start fires, right? And they're saying, you know, didn't firemen used to put out fires? It's kind of like the Federal Reserve now. You know, now they're trying to create inflation. Their job is to create inflation. But at one time, theoretically, their job was to fight inflation. Now their job is to create it. That's the kind of world that we're living in. Meanwhile, you know, this idea that people will, you know, not buy things if they think they can get them cheaper in the future, an easy way to refute that is look at the use of credit cards. How many people in America that can't afford something buy it anyway by using a credit card? Because when they do that, they add about 10 or 15 or 20% to the cost because they have to pay the interest. So if they really were so concerned about saving money, they wouldn't use their credit cards. They would just wait until they had the money and then buy the goods a year or two later. We all want low prices. The only people who don't want low prices are debtors. See, because if debtors have borrowed a lot of money, they want inflation. They want to be able to pay back the money they borrowed with inflated dollars. So if you've borrowed a lot of money, then yes, a lot of inflation will help you out. But it's not a coincidence, you know, who is the biggest debtor of them all? Who's borrowed more money than anybody on the planet? The government. So that's why the government wants inflation. Of course, the government is also pinning its economic hopes on asset bubbles, the wealth effect, rising stock prices, rising real estate prices. They need inflation to sustain that. So because the government wants to keep inflating the bubbles, because the government wants to inflate away its debts, right, that's why it needs inflation. You know, another reason they need inflation is to lower the minimum wage. You know, they impose the minimum wage, which creates unemployment because it prices unskilled laborers out of the market. And what they do is they create inflation to reduce the value of wages so that employers can afford to hire the people that the minimum wage law made unemployable. So it's like a government bailout.
But you also point out that the mainline thinking promotes inflation, you know, to keep, as you mentioned, unemployment low. But that this is really an illusion. If prices were allowed to fall to their equilibrium level, workers would have more disposable income. And then that income would be spent on goods and services, and this would help right the economy. Wouldn't this reduce the magnitude and regularity of our economic downturns, Peter?
We wouldn't even have economic downturns if the government wasn't manipulating the money supply. You know, the business cycle is a byproduct of government manipulation. It's the monetary policy that's behind it. But if we really want true prosperity that raises the standard of living of the poorest among us and the middle class, we need capitalism. We need to go back to what worked in the 19th century, which is limited government, freedom, free enterprise, sound money, limited government, which means no taxes or very low taxes, certainly no income taxes or payroll taxes. We want taxes that don't do economic harm, sales taxes, for example, you know, import taxes, stuff like that, taxes that you can pay without thinking about it, taxes where you don't need financial planning, where you don't need accountants and lawyers, you know, and, you know, stuff like that, and where the government doesn't need an army of tax collectors and tax preparers. You know, we got to eliminate the entire industry of financial planning. It is a waste. It is a waste of our resources to try to figure out how to protect our money from government theft.
Now, you also offer a panacea, though, for inflation. You say that legislators should implement a balanced budget. You've talked about the Fed, but you haven't mentioned the balanced budget to avoid debt there. What do you think?
Yeah, well, if the Fed wasn't monetizing the debt, we would have a balanced budget because interest rates would be too high. The government couldn't afford to borrow. So the government and the Federal Reserve are working hand in hand to rob Americans blind. But those of us, you know, there are people who say we need inflation because governments have all this debt, and so inflation will ease that burden. Yes, but the solution isn't to create inflation to wipe out government debt. The solution is for governments not to go into debt in the first place, and then they won't need inflation to wipe it out.
Moving on to the precious metal sector, you know, so far this year, it's up by about 5%, but the media is once again bashing the metals. They're discussing the rally only in terms of last year's reaction. It looks like they're missing the significant fact that the bottom might be in place here.
Yeah, everybody wants to talk about how last year was the worst year for gold in 20 or 30 years, and that this is just a dead cat bounce. You know, the only reason that gold sold off so hard in the second half of 2013 was because so many people jumped to the wrong conclusion at the same time. The Fed said that they were going to end QE, and a bunch of people believed it. They actually believed that the Fed could not only stop buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, but it could actually start selling the ones that it already owns, and somehow it could do that without spiking interest rates and collapsing the economy, which is a fantasy. It can't be done. So the people who sold gold did it based on a false premise. But they all did it at the same time. And you had years and years of buying liquidated in a matter of months, and so the price dropped. But I think all of the gold that the speculators unloaded in the second half of 2013 has been bought by entities that have no intention of ever selling it. Once the market turns around, and I think it's, you know, it probably has already bottomed, and we're surprising everybody with the rally thus far in 2014, which I think will gather momentum as the year progresses, especially when we get more of the economic data coming out this spring, which does not show an improvement over the winter, in fact, which may even continue to deteriorate because everybody has been dismissing all the bad news as if it was solely related to the cold weather. But when they realize that it wasn't the weather, it was that the economy was legitimately slowing down and the weather was a minimal, if any, factor, then more and more people are going to realize that the Fed is not going to end QE, that they're going to halt the taper and, in fact, reverse course, which I think they will do before the end of the year, in an attempt to avoid recession or stimulate the economy or prop up the sagging stock and real estate markets, then I think gold takes off. And a lot of people who sold it are going to want to buy it back. The problem is going to be, where are they going to get the metal?
Speaking of where they're going to get the metal, you talk about the StreetTrax Gold ETF, GLD, reversing course, accumulating significant bullion in its stockpile. You know, it's not the only ETF out there. There are numerous gold ETFs around the world.
Oh, yeah.
They've got to buy back the gold they've sold off. And if China absorbed in Asia, that is, the Asian nations, absorbed much of that stockpile, I mean, this could be a huge impetus sending the metals higher.
Who really has to buy it back? The shorts. There are a lot of short sellers in this market. They got into the market late last year. In fact, I remember watching, you know, television on CNBC. They'd bring up a portfolio manager, and they'd ask them, well, what are you doing? And almost everybody was saying, well, we're short gold. And I had never, in all my years, heard so many people who have probably never traded gold come out and confess that they're now short. Because everybody believed that it was a free trade, that it was a no-brainer, that if you shorted gold, you'd make 20 or 30% because it was going to collapse, you know, for sure. And now they're all stuck in this trade. They're all losing. They're on the wrong side of the market. They're hoping that things turn around. But at some point, as the price goes higher and higher and higher, and they can't endure the pain anymore, they're going to be forced to cover these short positions. And when the shorts look to cover, again, who are they going to buy from when they've been supplying the market, the metal to the market? It's the shorts that have been enabling people to buy gold, except they've been selling gold that they don't even own.
You compare gold to the price of Dow, you know, the equities index, and you see in order for it to get back to its historical average, either gold must move higher or the Dow must decline sharply, and you seem to think that both will occur. Will investors roll their stock gains into the precious metals?
Yeah, well, I don't know how much the Dow is going to decline. So I think most of that is going to be made up with gold prices going up, right? I mean, not so much the Dow going down, because I do believe that they'll print enough money to put a floor beneath the stock market. So I don't think, you know, they're going to meet at 2 or 3,000, right? I think they're going to meet at a much higher level. By the time they're 1-to-1 again, it'll probably be with gold, you know, with a Dow, you know, 5 to 10,000, if not higher. So I'm not looking for a collapse in the Dow. But, you know, the Dow could certainly move down. The NASDAQ, I think, is the most vulnerable there, because there you have, you know, so much hype and so much fluff in the stocks that are in that index. So there's more downside for these, you know, momentum, pie in the sky, no earnings, you know, all sizzle, no steak type stocks. But, you know, people just should be buying gold. The gold stocks, I think, are, you know, for people who really want to, you know, swing for the fences, there is tremendous upside in the mining stocks, because they're priced for, you know, collapsed gold prices. You know, when gold prices don't collapse, when they, in fact, go way up, these assets have to be totally repriced, because they have to be looked at in a totally different light.
Oh, yeah, no, as a sector, I mean, we're talking about very fairly valued price-to-earnings ratios. You know, take a look at, like, Netflix, Google, Apple, and many others. I mean, they're priced for perfection, and we're starting to see the fallout there. So,
I mean, I looked through my own portfolio, and about, you know, just about the only stocks that I have, you know, that are lower than I paid for them are gold stocks. You know, so all the other stocks I have gone up, and some of my gold stocks have gone up. They're the best values.
You also question whether or not the Fed can sustain the asset bubbles if it simply supplies enough air in the form of freshly minted QE cash and zero interest rates. Could the economy be moving from too big to fail into the realm of too big to bail?
It is too big to bail, and that's why I think the Fed thinks the bubbles are too big to pop. That's why they want to keep them inflated, but they can't do it forever. They can't keep printing money without collapsing the dollar, and I think that's the real collateral damage. The Fed will keep printing money to keep the bond market propped up, to keep the equity markets and the housing market propped up, to keep the government in business, to enable them to keep borrowing and spending, so they'll keep printing and printing and printing until the bottom drops out of the dollar, which will happen eventually. It should have already happened. But, you know, the world has a lot more confidence in our money than they should. But, you know, eventually, you know, they won't. And the confidence will fail. And that's the crisis that we're heading to. And that's the one that people need to be prepared for. What we needed was lower housing prices. But what we got was a reflated bubble where you have hedge funds and private equity guys speculating in the single-family home market. You have homeownership rates plunging to 20- and 30-year lows as hedge funds are leveraged up with empty houses. So the government has reflated a bubble that will burst, you know, as interest rates rise and when these hedge funds look to unload these properties that they can't rent out. Meanwhile, nobody can afford to buy them either. So, look, we're perched on a very precarious ledge, and they're going to just keep printing money because they're afraid of stopping. And I think it's all a bluff, and I don't even know if the Fed believes what they're saying with respect to being able to stop the QE. Maybe they don't. Maybe they believe it. Maybe they're just pretending. But they're going to stop. The data is going to come out, and it's going to be too negative, and the Fed's going to be going to have to do something, and they're going to do what they do, which is print money. Even though it doesn't work, that's the only tool in their shed. In their box, right? So they'll keep using it.
No, I can confirm everything you've said. You know, industry insiders here on the show in the housing sector claim that the, as you say, hedge funds, and not just hedge funds, many of these other entities that are gobbling up the McMansion debt checks, they plan to dump those on the market as soon as they move a bit higher and rates start to ratchet up.
Sell to who? There's no one to sell to. They're the main buyers. They can't turn around and sell. It's just like the Fed. The Fed has got all these bonds and mortgage-backed securities. It's got a $4 trillion balance sheet, and people think they can turn around and become a seller.
Well, maybe the government will buy it up, and they'll sell us back our homes.
Remind your listeners that the new version of the real crash just came out last week. That's the real crash, America's coming bankruptcy, how to save yourself and your future and your country. Right? It's got over 100 new pages, so it's 444 pages now. It's the brand new, fully revised and updated version of the real crash. So pick up a copy. Even if you read the original, it's worth buying a new one to get the extra 100 pages. And don't forget, I'm doing my own radio show, the Peter Schiff Show, every weekday from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time. Schiffradio.com is the URL. You can listen live, or in fact, you can go to that website any time of day and listen to the most recent show for free.
We're going to have links to both on the webpage today.
Thank you.
Dennis Miller consults with Fortune 500 companies, and he's trained hundreds of executives at GE, Mobil, Shell, Schlumberger, HP, IBM, and many more. He recently penned Retirement Reboot and has a monthly newsletter, Money Forever, and his free journal, Miller's Money Weekly, to help folks prepare a safe retirement portfolio for his subscribers. And you know, as many as 500,000 baby boomers are retiring each month. This trend is going to persist for years to come. Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, Mr. Miller.
Chris, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
In your service, Miller's Money, you show subscribers how to avoid catastrophic losses in your model portfolio, and you've recently added some interesting high-yield bond funds to the portfolio. I wonder if you could outline how these higher yields are worth the additional risk that can accompany them. Maybe you could tell people just what inspired your decision.
Well, that's a good question. You got the tough one right off the bat. I want to share with you a quick story. A few months ago, I was a guest at a presentation by the head of the bond department of a major brokerage firm. Now, I'm soon to be 74 years old, and let's just say I was with my peer group in the audience, okay? He went through this presentation, and the gist of his presentation was he was talking about, you know, the high-quality AAA, AA-rated corporate bonds, you know, the solid citizens, the utility bonds. And what he suggested was, so that you can get some higher rates, that these folks, and for argument's sake, you had $80,000, you ladder them over 8 years so that you'd go into $10,000 a year. And then each year when one matures, you buy another one that's 8 years out. And that was his premise, his approach, rather, for safety and getting higher yield. Now, I looked at that, and it was interesting because one of the participants raised the question about inflation. And he said, well, right now the government reported inflation is around 2%, and it seems to be under control. Then he also said something to the, yeah, if you believe inflation is under control, I'll tell you something that happened to me recently. I took my daughter and her husband and two grandchildren to the ballpark Take a family to the ballpark and buy them lunch and tell me inflation is 2%. But anyway, somebody also asked about the higher yielding junk bonds. And his comment was, well, they don't call them junk bonds for nothing. You have to be very selective with it, but there can be money made doing that. And he said, we've actually put together some portfolios where it would never in our history have our investors lost money. Now, my first reaction to that was not losing money is a good place to start, but we have a little higher goal than that. So I didn't say anything, and I got home, and I went on their website. And if you were to follow that philosophy of buying top-quality bonds, ladder them out over 8 years, average interest rate would be less than 2% because that's just what the market is paying. And I'm sitting there saying, you and I both have our feelings about inflation versus what the government reports. Certainly anybody that is listening to goldseek.com is very aware of the inflation and the problems it can pose for us. And I said, why would we go into an investment and tie up our money for as long as 8 years when we know by the time we pay taxes we're going to end up with less buying power than we got started? So I came back to our analyst team, and basically we all came to the same conclusion. A lot of consumers, when they talk to their broker or talk to their bond person, they talk about safety. And what they don't understand is, while they're talking about safety from default, there are a lot of other risks that are come into the picture when you're buying bonds, and they need to be factored into the equation. AAA bonds are safe, but they don't protect you from everything.
There's so many issues that surround bonds. I guess we could look at this from either perspective. We could look at it as they're, in general, much safer than the typical equity because the debt holder and the stakeholder has first priority in the event of a bankruptcy over shareholders and equity holders. But there's so many other interesting aspects of this story that I know we're going to delve into later on in this discussion. So let's move on to another question. In the wake of the 2008 credit crisis, the preponderance of study findings show that a primary culprit behind the economic implosion was the incentive system where the top ratings agencies such as Fitch, S&P, Moody's, and others are paid by the bond issuers, which creates a form of what I call anti-transparency where bond issuers shop around for the best rating. Can you help alleviate some of our listeners' concerns about the foxes who appear to be guarding the bond investment rating henhouse?
Well, that's an interesting question you asked because, you know, I get asked a lot of times about just something basic. Explain what the bond ratings are. And as you well know, there's only two different, or there's two major firms. There's Moody's and Standard & Poor's that assign a rating to the bond issues. Now, I explain the bond rating is like a personal credit score. You know, every one of us has a credit score. So somebody goes in and they apply for an auto loan. If they got a credit score in the 800s versus somebody who wants to borrow the same amount of money on the same auto that might have a credit score in the 600s, the fact is the person with a higher credit score is going to be charged a lower amount of interest. So the incentive system from the borrower is, of course, they're going to find the one that's going to give them the best rating because they're going to save millions and millions of dollars in interest based on that rating because that rating reflects the interest that they have to pay to borrow other people's money. Now, the fact that there was some apparent hanky-panky going on should not have been a surprise to most people. So we just like to talk about it as a general rule. And, you know, as a general rule, if you go back, you have to look at the historical default rate. And a historical default rate using the S&P is like, these are capital letters. Instead of using numbers, they go AAA, which is capitals, and they go down to a D, which is in default. And then some of them are small letters versus capital. But as a general rule, down to BBB with capital Bs, the historical default rate is pretty close to zero. So that's the way we have to go back and look at it and say, forgetting their ratings, let's look at the historical default rate, and then we'll pick the default rate that we are comfortable with relative to the interest rates. Now, then you start go down to D. Well, they're already in default, but between that, the triple B, and down to the C, which is you're starting to be concerned about default, there's a sweet spot in there where you still have good quality companies. Yes, you might have a little higher default rate, but the interest rate that you earn as commensurate with your risk makes it worth it. Otherwise, banks wouldn't lend money to people with credit scores in the 600. Well, the reason they do it is they charge them more interest, and that additional interest offsets some of their losses. So my point is, I'm not as inclined to worry so much about the rating of the individual bond. I'm going to look at it more as the historical default rate and whether the bond rating agencies were incentivized to rate them high or low. The historical default rate tells the story.
You know, I would underscore the significance of what you've just outlined. It really is the historical default that gives investors, I think, that peace of mind and perspective. Extrapolate forward just what they should expect. And as you say, this is such an infinitesimally small figure. It gives, I think, investors the confidence to sleep well at night. And I'd like to move on to another point here. You know, bonds typically carry less risk than equities, and we've already addressed some of the reasons why, entitled to bankruptcy proceedings in advance of equities. But less well understood risks include inflation. Since the bond price is inversely related, of course, or correlated with the current interest rate, inflation erodes not only the principal, but of course the present value of future cash flows, known as coupon payment. This is what our listeners might think of as dividends with stocks, but we have coupons with bonds. Now, there is some risk associated with opportunity cost, and using the capital asset pricing model, the CAPM, as our guide, you know, the expected return on bonds is well below that of stocks. I wonder if you could outline the risks, including the opportunity costs associated with bond investing, please.
You know, within our Miller's Money, we have a model portfolio. And we are showing folks that are thinking about retiring or retiring how to invest money to stay ahead of inflation, to supplement their Social Security, and keep those risks to a minimum. So that while you talked about bonds in relation to stock, on the stock side, you have to surgically protect pick your stocks, diversification, stop losses. We're not going to go there for today's discussion. But we don't recommend going all in there because every retiree's portfolio should be limited on that because, you know, we saw what's happened at Amazon. You know, you want to get the high flyers on the way up. But the reality is, look what happened in 2008 where some people that I know took a 40 to 50% hit in their portfolio. So you want to talk about risk. The market right now is at an all-time high, and the risk of a tumbling are significant. So that you've got to burn the candle at both ends, and you've got to put some money into fixed income. But when you talk about the risk of the fixed income, bonds definitely have a place in your portfolio. And you talked about the difference between interest rates. Let me give you an example of one I wrote about recently in an article, and you'll find this on our millersmoney.com website. We took two Guggenheim bond funds. Both of these, this is exchange-traded funds, have maturity dates, target maturity dates in 2018. Now, one of them, the symbol is BSCI. It's a top-quality corporate bond fund. It's currently paying a 2.2% yield. Now, their other fund is called BSJI, and these are the higher yielding, higher risk bonds, and they're lower rated, and it's paying 4.9% interest, over double what the first fund pays. So when you want to look at risk, you can look at the rating, but you can also say, what's the default rate the lower risk bonds, because I know if I go into a fund paying me 2.2% interest, particularly if it's in a taxable account, when that bond matures, I have less buying power than when I started. At least with the 4.9%, and we'll talk a little bit later about how to decide which funds you go in and some steps you want to take, you have a shot at least keeping up with inflation and having a little bit of money left over. So the risk has to be the balance between the two. Where inflation really comes in, and Chris, I have to believe that your GoldSeek listeners probably will understand this better than most. We took a situation during the Jimmy Carter years, and we said, okay, let's suppose investor A buys a $100,000, 5%, 5-year certificate of deposit, right in the Carter years before they went into high inflation. And we said, to keep it a simple illustration, so he buys this, and let's say that one of his favorite cars, a Ford, was $25,000 a piece. So basically, he took the money that he could buy four $25,000 Fords and lent it to the bank. So 5 years later, he has all his money back, plus he has all his interest. But when you factored in the double-digit inflation, which a lot of people believe is on our horizon, that they had in the Carter years, he actually lost 25.9%, I believe it was, of his buying power. In other words, at the end of 5 years, you apply that same inflation to the price of the Ford, now he can only buy three Fords and have a little gas money left over. And then when you use inflation, one of the biggest challenges we have as newsletter writers is to try to get the audience to understand that you might have more money in the end of your account when that bond or that CD matures. But if it buys less than when you started, you've taken a major, major hit.
Of course, we're referring to purchasing power here, and we're also talking about the expected return of your portfolio. For instance, let's say we earn 5% over the next 5 years, but if inflation, true inflation, in the neighborhood of 6%, we actually have lost purchasing power. We feel richer, that is, until we go shopping, or we try to purchase a home, or we pay our bills. I'd like to also underscore this Guggenheim Bullet Shares 2018 High Yield Corporate Bond ETF. This is my favorite of the two you've picked. Took a long look at both companies, and the holdings on both of these are solid. These are not fly-by-night junk bonds. In fact, I don't think they've earned that moniker. I prefer high yield. It's so well diversified that I think our listeners will have some peace of mind here. Any portfolio would benefit.
You've done something, though, that I think your listeners need to understand, because when we are looking at bonds, and we have some of the Guggenheim funds in our model portfolio, we have to look at it in combination of interest rates, default, and also we are strong believers that you should hold the bonds to maturity. We're not traders here. We're looking for yield. But there is also a third thing called the resale value. It's called effective duration. Oddly enough, those two Guggenheim funds, if the interest rate drop, the higher yield fund will not drop as much as far as resale value goes. I don't want to dwell on it a lot because realistically, you want to hold them to maturity. You just want to have to hold them for 5 or 6 years at below market interest rate. But what we suggest is exactly what you outlined, and I really want your listeners to understand it. When you get something like the prospectus for that Guggenheim fund, do as Chris suggested. Look at their holdings. We look at it from so many different perspectives. For example, our analyst team has got a real axe to grind as far as financials are concerned. They really don't want a whole lot of in the financial sector. I've got a real axe to grind because I grew up in Chicago, and I see what's happening in Michigan, and I see what's happening in Illinois. So you're looking at diversification, good companies among sectors, geographically, and you have to take a look at it. And the second part is, I don't want any holding in that fund any more than 1 to 2% of the total amount of the fund. So if it does default, it's not a catastrophic event for you. And is it worth the almost double the rate of the safer corporate bond fund? I'm with you. Once you've done your homework and you've vetted it, I think for the next 3 or 4 years, that's a good place to go, because you have a better shot at staying ahead of inflation. And, yeah, your default rate is going to be a little higher, but your net gain is still going to be better.
Key ratios that need to be examined in some of those holdings. For instance, I really like to bullet down into the interest coverage of the companies behind the debt. Let's take Chrysler, for instance. I like to look at their interest coverage, make sure they're not having or going to have any difficulty covering debt. And I also like to take a look at the debt to equity ratio, give folks an idea of just how much debt have they taken on, which could perhaps sink the Titanic. I wonder if you could tell subscribers and listeners, what are you telling your subscribers today is the right track for their investment portfolio?
That's a good one. I think what I'd like to do, you talked about ratios, is we've put together a model portfolio. And this model portfolio is for anyone who is investing money that they have to have for retirement. Now, we have surgically picked some well-diversified portfolio of stocks, and you know, many of them now were into nice double-digit gains and nice dividends on top and all the things you would expect to do by picking the right stocks in a rising market. Now, with that being said, diversification is still the holy grail of safety. So on the stock side, we recommend no more than 5% of your overall portfolio in any single issue. I don't care how hot it is, how much you think it's going to be, you know, the next Amazon or Google or whatever it is. And then we will put in a 20% trailing stop loss. Now, Chris, you can go through the math and say, what's the worst-case scenario? The worst-case scenario is you'd lose 1% on your investment if you got stopped out, 1% meaning of your overall portfolio. Well, if you only have 50% of your portfolio in there, okay, then in effect you're talking about losing maybe 10 stocks at 5%, so you could max lose 10% overall if Armageddon took place. A lot of people in the crash in 2007 or 2008 would have been delighted to only have had 10% losses. Now, when we go to the bond side, we also recommend a position in to fixed income. But here is what we're having to deal with, and that is what we're having to deal with is the inflation factor. Why would anybody buy a 10-year, I don't care how solid it is, certificate deposit or anything else when the interest rate is guaranteed not to keep up with inflation? So what we've had to do was, and I can share these with you, you know, our subscribers pay us for our picks, and we can't divulge them until we've had them in our portfolio for over 30 days. But right now, we've got in our portfolio the Guggenheim, and the symbol is BSJF, and BSJG, which is the 2015 and 2016 version of the fund that we talked about earlier. And like I started at the beginning, where the gentleman was talking about laddering out over 8 years, our feeling is these are not necessarily going to be the greatest inflation fighters in the world, but at least you have a better shot of staying ahead. And you can go out, like you said, to that 2018 fund. But I would say to somebody, if you have $40,000, I'd go 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018. And then when you get around to the first quarter of 2015, sell that and go out to 2019. So ladder those high-yield funds in no more than 4-year ladders. And that's going to give you a pretty good bit of safety, And on that fixed income side of your portfolio, you're going to get some yields that at least should be able to keep you up with, if not beat inflation. You've got to diversify. You cannot be all in bonds. You cannot be all in the stock market. And Lord knows anybody who's sitting all in cash is into trouble. And part of that portfolio better have some gold and silver and some other big inflation hedges. It's all got to fit together.
I like the sound of that. You're talking about diversifying even market risk away, and so few analysts and financial prognosticators seem to grasp the significance of that. All you have to do is go back to a chart of 2008, and you can superimpose bonds with stocks, and then, let's say, stocks with gold, and you start to realize that when the difficult times come, you need a component of your portfolio to compensate for the wild gyrations that we have experienced in our markets in the past 10 years in particular. And I think you'd probably concur with the notion that we should expect significant volatility in these markets.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And let me talk to the baby boomers out there for a minute. There are several differences today in 2014 than we had even 10 years ago. And that is our biological clock is ticking. You know, we're sitting here at the market now at an all-time high. It crashed 7 years ago in round numbers. The crashes that we have seen in our lifetime and the recoveries have all taken 5 to 7 years. Chris, the graph that really scares me is the 1929 graph, because it took 25 years before the market came back. Now, can you guarantee me, with the things that we're seeing now, with the Federal Reserve printing a 100-year supply of money every year for the last 4 to 5 years, that if we have another crash, that it's going to come back in 4 to 5 years as opposed to 25? As a guy who is retired and working with a lot of baby boomers who are concerned about it, their biological clock doesn't allow them to risk something that may or may not come back in 7 to 25 years.
We have to have contingency plans in place. It's so ironic that people don't think even twice about having insurance on their automobile, insurance on the greatest investment they thought of their life, which was their home, but they forget all about their retirement funds. And once again, just take a look at 2008, see how bond funds exploded in value as stocks imploded in value. It's just another tool to secure your family's future and your retirement. I wonder if you could tell us about just how well this has performed. As I understand, we're looking at, on average, over 24%. That was at the March issue, giving folks a really solid start on their retirement. When you factor in all of the aspects, this looks like a wonderful opportunity for people. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more as we wrap up our discussion today, please.
Yeah, well, we followed your model, and that is you've got to burn the candle at both ends between the stock market and bonds and fixed income and cash and gold and silver. It's the combination that a lot of people struggle with from a safety perspective. So if the market tanks, we still are covered here. If interest rates are a little lower, we'll get it from the market. Right now, the 50% of our portfolio that we have in the market, I believe the number in March, and I don't have it right in front of me, we were averaging something like a 20% gain or something like that. So the portfolio side of the market that is, the portfolio side rather we have in the market is doing very, very well. And it is well diversified geographically and among sectors. So that half of the portfolio is going to keep any retiree ahead of inflation and throwing off some supplemental income to add to their Social Security. Then the other half we have in the secure, safer fixed income side, like the Guggenheim funds and things like that. And what we're looking for is what we talked about today. Safe things that if the market drops like a rock, we're still getting a good yield here, and they are, you know, keeping us in the game so that the net effect of the entire portfolio is giving our subscribers enough of a yield to stay ahead of inflation make sure that their buying power at the end of the year is a lot more than it was in the beginning of the year. But unlike when we were working full-time, we can also tap into it and take some of that money as we need it to pay the bills. And so far, we've done very well, as I said, with the double-digit yield. And stack that up with the safety that we have, we're very, very comfortable with it. If the market crashes, sure, we're going to take a hit. But we'll be well ahead of most, unlike what happened in 2008.
I think it's well said. And, you know, as we were talking before the show, folks just really want to buy the sizzle. It's difficult to focus on the risk side of the equation when the return is making the headline news every day. Higher highs in the equities market. Tesla is on fire. Oh, Netflix is the next Apple or the next Microsoft. It's very difficult to keep one's mind focused there. But, you know, if suddenly we do enter even just 2008, not even 1929, where you lost 89%, almost 90% from peak to trough, but if we did enter 2008-like conditions once again, losing 50% of my portfolio is going to require a 100% return just to get back to break even. But you know, if I'd had a nice solid core holding in these bonds, more than likely most of that loss would have been offset and I would have been earning a yield all during that time.
As well as the stop losses on the stock side, so you don't take 50%, because I want to go one step further. If we had another 2008 crash today, tell me what tools the Federal Reserve has to bail us out another time. They've already taken interest rates down to what they call negative rates, meaning they're not keeping up with inflation. They don't have any ammunition left in their arsenal if it happens again.
It's so well said. I mean, what are they going to come up with, a derivative of quantitative easing? We've already lost our AAA status, at least according to one ratings agency. I believe it's S&P. We're starting to run out of ammunition at the Federal Reserve. Their options are limited. Imagine if they had to backtrack now after just starting this tapering program that's supposed to wrap up sometime by the end of this year or early next year, where they hypothetically claim they're going to raise interest rates. That will be quite interesting. I think you'd see the nascent housing recovery implode if mortgage rates started to ratchet up even a few percent. So it's interesting times ahead, and that's why I think this information today is so salient. We have to keep the risk side of the equation in focus. All right, Dennis Miller, we want to thank you today for an enlightening and information-packed discussion. Any other contact information for our listeners or anything else on your radar screen, sir?
Last week, I wrote an article about the concept behind the bonds and talking about the bond funds that we talked about. So if any of them want further information, they can go to the website and they can find some articles on that. And if they want to, you know, go into being paid subscribers, which is $99 a year, so it's not going to break anybody's bank, we've actually got some special reports where we have written a special report that's got a lot of play. And it's part of the subscription called Bond Basics. And if anybody is interested in going into bonds, the feedback we've got from that is one of the best primers going. So if they want further information, they can go to your website. You'll show them all the way to find us. And we really are focusing now on bonds just as much as we are stocks.
You know, we'll take it a step further. We're actually going to include this contact information for all of my subscribers via email. So you will receive this in your email box and you can just make a convenient click there, whether it be through your mobile phone or at your desktop or laptop computers. Dennis Miller, we want to thank you for joining us today. And we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Several months ago, I did a commentary discussing the timing of the next major slide in the housing market would be toward the third quarter of 2014 or early in 2015. It's starting, and it's starting to be noticed. The real estate show I listen to while running errands each weekend in Nevada just announced that demand has slid 20% and inventory is up 50%, and it's going to get worse. According to a CNBC interview with Realty Track this week, the pool of underwater borrowers, classified as seriously underwater, peaked at 12.8 million, which was 29% of all properties with a mortgage in the second quarter of 2012. Rising prices over the past year have apparently pushed some of those homeowners back above water. Realty Track says during the first quarter of 2014, 9.1 million homes, or 17% of homes with mortgages, were seriously underwater, which means owing at least 25% more than the property's estimated market value. Right now, certain areas of the U.S. are still suffering badly. In Fresno and Stockton, California, some homeowners are still 20 to 40% underwater. In Nevada, 34% of homeowners remain underwater. In Florida, 31%. In Illinois, 30%. In Michigan, 29%. In Ohio, 27%. And the list goes on. The myth of a recovering economy is just that, a myth. And now, with local media beginning to report that demand is slipping and inventories are rising, indicates a trend that has been acknowledged on this broadcast for quite some time, but once again is now only beginning to seep its way into the national consciousness. Once again, it will be too late for most. The trend is clear. Rising inventories, slipping demand, and over time, higher interest rates. Millions of homeowners can still lose their home to short sales. In markets where prices are appreciating, banks are waiting for properties to appreciate and then foreclosing on homeowners who are behind on their payments. If you live in or are visiting a troubled real estate market like Nevada, California, Florida, Michigan, or any other, I encourage you to listen to the local real estate weekend shows hosted by local attorneys. They are entertaining and give you an early warning signal of what the national media is often weeks or months behind in reporting. People are beginning to realize the dead cat bounce in rising home values the past 2 years were not a trend of sustainability. They were not representative of an expanding or recovering economy as sold to us by statistically illiterate elected officials whose only objective was re-election. They were the result of an end to low interest rates and a reversal of institutional investors from buyer to seller status in the residential housing market. The housing crisis never ended. We are headed into our 7th year of it. And while it may have gone off some people's radar screens the past 2 years, it has always been there. And later this year, and especially next year, it will resume its rightful place, center stage, in the next chapter of the U.S. financial crisis. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.